Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This week, the Bookshelf Cinema is screening The Trip to Italy, Cavalry, The Grand Seduction, The Fault in Our Stars, and Boyhood, among other films. On Thursday, September 11th, the Eden Mills Writers Festival presents Scott Merritt, Sandro Perry, Carl Wilson, Shawn Michaels, and Golden Throats Karaoke for a music and literature event at the E-Bar called Taste and Transmission. And on Tuesday, September 16th, in the Green Room, Professor Stephen Hennigan launches his new book, Sandino's Nation, Literature and Revolution in Nicaragua. Also, on Tuesday, September 16th, Fearing and White play the E-Bar. The Bookshelf is an independently owned culture hub located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph. Visit bookshelf.ca for more information.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Very excited about this show. It's a chat with Scott Merritt. He's an old friend of mine. I kind of met Scott, as you'll hear, I met Scott through his son, John, really, John Merritt. John was just a little kid. He used to play music, and I was playing music at the same time, and I was much older than John, but I got to know his dad and his mom. And Scott Merritt is a songwriting legend in sort of underground music circles throughout Canada. And he hasn't made a new record in 12 years, but he's playing a show in Guelph on Thursday, September 11th at the E-Bar, along with Sandro Perry, and there's going to be a literature component as well. Carl Wilson is going to be reading. You remember Carl Wilson and Shawn Michaels? They were on the show some months ago talking about their books. Well, they're going to do some reading and chatting, and then Sandro Perry's going to play, and Scott's going to play. And Scott, as you'll hear, hasn't put out a new record since 2002, and people were wondering about it. Well, there's news about that on the episode. You're even going to hear a brand new song. So, very exciting. Here it is, myself and Scott Merritt.
The Eden Mills Writers Festival is gearing up for its 2014 program, which runs September 11th to 15th, both in the city of Guelph and just 10 minutes east in the beautiful village of Eden Mills. Confirmed authors and musicians include Eleanor Catton, Lynn Cody, David Adam Richards, Miriam Taves, Ann Michaels, Heather O'Neill, Terry Fallis, Scott Merritt, Sandro Perry, Shawn Michaels, Carl Wilson, and many more. There's also the 100 Story Wood Workshop, which unites Canadian authors and high school students for a day of writing on Monday, September 15th. For more information and to purchase tickets or sign up for workshops, please visit EdenMillsWritersFestival.ca. Or is it changing?
nurse a call, 4 in the morning. Find the coat, sit on the step, and watch that streetlight, and try and figure out that dream. A cage on a house, a cage on a house, what do you make? Mercy on your fool. Roll it back a bit. Mercy on your fool, Lord. Give it a name. Give it a name.
This is a lovely view. I can't remember the last time I was at the cottage.
I don't know either.
It's been a while, yeah.
It's work in progress.
It's still a work in progress.
They're mixing, Nick Chelios is mixing somebody today, so it's good to be back here instead of there. But it's generally good to be here than there, over there. Anyways.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely view. You've lived in Guelph for how long?
I guess 17, 18 years,
wow.
Possibly, yeah.
And what brought you here?
John, I guess, was part of it, and also what I was up to. Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
And also what I was up to. John was just, just beyond toddling, and the town in Brantford where we were living, started to feel a little. A little claustrophobic, and also the cottage thing was just sort of getting legs, and it was also a limitation where we were located, in a way. And so I just started looking around various towns around Brantford, and the attraction was largely that whenever I came to Guelph to sort of scout out places, there was all these neat places. I just liked the way the houses were laid out in the yards, and there were these often outbuildings behind houses.
Sheds and stuff.
I thought, oh, that'd be neat if we could find some place like that. And the other thing I noticed was that there was, every time I came here, I got lost, which I thought was a good sign, because I could never get the feel of how the town was laid out.
And you saw this as a virtue?
I thought it was a great virtue, yeah, because I knew Brantford so well,
yeah.
So that was an advantage. And this place came up, which was, had the advantage of looking like the downstairs could be used for a studio, so no outbuilding. So we thought it would be a good fit. So far, so good.
17, 18 years, so that's about the same time I've been here.
Is that right?
I came here for undergraduate studies. It's a university town, for those who don't know. In, 1996. And so you were here around the same time?
Yeah, around the same time, yeah.
And
you've been 97 maybe.
Yeah, no, I'm just.
John was in grade 5.
And you and I really met because of John.
I think. Yeah.
I mean, we.
I'm sure that would have been the reason. Yeah.
Your son John plays drums, and at the time when he was in the Bar Mitzvah Brothers.
Yeah.
Who somehow I saw play. And how old would he have been?
I don't know when they. I guess I go more, not so much by age, but by what grade he was in.
Right.
I'd say he was maybe in grade 7 or 8.
Yeah, so he would have been like 11 or 12? No. Is that right?
No. Like grade 8 would be 14, no?
I'm trying to think. I was in grade 9, I think I was 13.
Well, you were an advanced type of person.
No, maybe, is that right? Okay, maybe I'm wrong. I thought grade 11, you're 16 roughly, I think.
Yeah.
So grade 10, you're 15. Grade 9, yeah, 13, 14. I'm a December kid, so
oh.
I was the youngest guy in my class.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. I think, is it possible he was
13?
Okay.
Let's go with 13.
It's not a fact-checking kind of conversation necessarily. I just, I was initially baffled by the Bar Mitzvah Brothers. I think as people always are, a little bit. They were a unique band. But it was so inspiring to see young kids playing music like that, and we did everything, us older people tried to encourage that as much as we could.
Yeah.
But did you have, was John's interest in music, I assume, it stems from being around you and your...
Maybe, you know, he sort of... Yeah, he always hung out around the top of the stairs, especially when drummers were around, and at the old place. And he would set up these... I think of it. He set up these little restaurants, John's Cafe, at the top of the stairs for when musicians came upstairs, you know?
Yeah.
And he would sell various dishes that he had cooked up, but he'd cook them up with Play-Doh. So they were not really edible. It was all very just much fiction in his mind. But now that I think of it, that was great.
He always struck me as the most fascinating member of the band, which was so it was Jenny Mitchell's in the band and Jordy Gordon and at the time probably Gillian Manford and a few other people. But the core was kind of John, Jenny,
and Jordy.
And John, I would drive them around. I was like their road manager.
Is that what you were doing?
Did you not know what your kid was up to?
No.
Just some strange guy driving him around in a van.
In a
scary van. Yeah, Ray Mitchell's classic thrift store
van. You were the
vans.
Only one they knew with a license, probably.
Yeah, I think it wasn't that they
and
liked me.
And you were game.
Yeah, I don't know why I was so interested in... I mean, that was my culture, too, was traveling around playing shows and in bands, and we would play together often, I think. So it was just maybe... It was social, and it was convenient. We were all kind of doing the same thing, but... Yeah, John would be like often in his own world. And he would bring, we were in Windsor once, and you know, while Jenny in particular was trying to act up in terms of her age, you know, get closer to us, I'd look over and John would be like playing with his soldiers and have these intricate battle sequences going on. Wow, and clearly like, it was like chess.
Yeah,
there was a lot going on in that kid's head, and he's I don't know. I wonder if that comes from, well, I mean, this obviously stems a little bit from his upbringing.
You know, yeah, we might have played a part in all that, but he was, he was always, we were always inventing things, and you know, when he was, I'd spend the afternoons with him often, and we, you know, we'd make little imaginary worlds, but I figured I was just doing the stuff that I wish my parents would have done with me, you know?
So yeah.
Sort of tried as much as possible. And the other thing we did, which, you know, was music related, I guess, was it was sort of, we banned, or I guess they put a moratorium on kids' music in the house, and we made the most out of real music, and using that and trying to get, play around those, you know, like play around Van Morrison or play around Tom Waits, you know, as opposed to having some chirpy high voice with robins in the background telling you about where you are.
And I did the same thing. My son's three, and you know, we go back and forth on it, but it did dawn on me at some point that I, for better or for worse, he is going to be into whatever we're into. And so initially, I think we took that route of like, well, we should probably play music by, you know, Fred Penner, Raffi, the Wiggles. And he, whatever you give a kid at that point, they're obsessed with it.
Yeah.
And so I gradually, when we were driving, we'd have to listen to these things. But I gradually was like, I kind of just want to listen to a Replacements record or the Ramones or whatever. And he loved it. And like, I think he was just like, oh, the car makes other sounds.
Right.
The stereo
right.
makes other sounds. I didn't know. And so.
Right, right.
For better or for worse now, and I don't know if you went through this, because you're teaching your kid about Tom Waits and whoever else, Van Morrison. On some level, when they get into their real world, the social world of other kids, when my kid knows the words to the first five Ramones albums, right. I'm trying to think about what kind of social capital he has right. in a playground where other kids are like, what? Yeah. Why are you listening to all this old music by these weird people?
And what did you listen to?
As a kid?
Yeah.
I have no... Well, my cousin Anand, I made him part of my wedding party, and which I don't think he really understood necessarily. We never talked about it, but he, when I was four, he introduced me. He had all these tapes. He had The Police, and he had Love and Rockets. This was the 80s.
Yeah.
82, I guess. 82, 83. So he had all these tapes, but he had this Beatles tape, and it was like a, I think it was like one of those Beatles play rock and roll. It was like a compilation. It wasn't even an album. But he played it, and I was just like, what the hell is this? At like four. I just remember hearing the Beatles for the first time, which, you know, I get the Beatles. It seems like a weird or an obvious
thing. Yeah, you know, but...
But there's something about, weirdly, any era, any age, like I think I heard the Beatles. So
what age is this now?
So I was four.
Four. Holy crow. Yeah.
I was four or five, I think, and I'm pretty sure that's what it was. I don't know. I didn't really make note of it, but when I think back, it must have been around that time. And yeah, I heard that, and he had U2 tapes, and this was my first real introduction to music. And I looked up to him. So I was just immediately infatuated with the Beatles, and I remember the first tape I bought at a Kmart was like the Beatles Ballads. Huh. Another compilation. I didn't get into the records for some reason. And yeah, I had an early interest in music. I used to, my dad had records, and he had a Dean Martin Christmas album, and I would put on concerts with a tennis racket.
For Dean Martin?
Whatever the records were, they'd be playing, and that one I got into. Right. And I don't remember anything about it now. And I would play lip sync with a tennis racket, and my parents looked at me. And within a few weeks, I was in tennis lessons. It's ridiculous.
That's not what I meant.
No. But it is interesting.
Cha-ching, cha-ching.
So do you remember what your earliest musical infatuations were, in memories?
Very vividly. The earliest ones were just imaginary things. Imaginary. And I don't know what would have inspired them, but I have the earliest recollections, like if you're going back to four, that would have been Pi played in Elastic Bands that I'm sure my mother would have hooked up.
Yeah.
And, you know, making as if it were a guitar and it's just strumming it and making up tunes, you know, like singing on top of it. I have no idea what. I have no recollection of what it was, but I know that was sort of the first instrument. And then, but as far as like eyes opening, like you're describing with, you know, this stuff you're listening to in the 80s would have been probably not till grade five or so when I met Stanley Plachenik, who was an 18-year-old guy that was in grade five.
Come on.
He wasn't 18. He was maybe 16. He was driving. He could drive to school. And I was in grade five. It was a split class. He was in grade six. He'd been held back so many times. He played trumpet in a band called Blues Syndicate.
Oh.
And I'm not sure what his, exactly what his whole story was. But I wonder about him a lot these days.
So you were
where he's at.
You were in grade five?
Yeah, it was grade five, and he knew was involved in something that was going on at the school, playing guitar in a, you know, just strum guitar in a class. Anyways, he took me on as a sort of to be my mentor of some kind, and took me back to his place one night after school, and no one was home at his place, and he played Foxy Lady and Manic Depression for me, and I really did. I think of it all the time as being an A-bomb. you know, it was really like everything changed.
Yeah.
Like in a matter of really the first couple of notes, you know, you hear of those things and you say, yeah, this is like nothing, you know, this was like nothing I've heard anywhere,
right,
but it's still music, you know? So that would be the two things I'd say about starting anyways, if I were asked.
I don't want to put too fine a point on this because life is funny and strange and weird, but it does strike me that you were drawn to a kid that was 6-7 years older than you probably at that time, maybe.
Yeah.
And so was John. John was drawn to these people that in a musical realm too.
Is that right?
Well, I think so.
Yeah,
I mean,
I guess that's
true. We were hanging out. I was probably 8 or 9. I think I'm 8 or 9 years older than John. I don't know how old John is. I can't remember. But yeah, and I'm not just counting me. Like, so there's a whole circle of these adults that were taking the Bar Mitzvah brothers and the different, you know, going to meetings with labels, and like we just ended up in these weird parental managerial roles or whatever. And it's funny that.
I never thought of that. That's
it's
true.
It's quite interesting that you might have a
more in common than I think with my own flesh and blood.
Well, I think the two of you. Well, you. I mean, I think in your work there's an interest. I don't know that it's a fixation, but in the fantastical, in the imaginary worlds. You know, I find a lot of the work that I've heard of yours is observational, but it's also on a different level, like trying to think of.
I think I see what you're saying.
Yeah. And so there's this kind of, it's not an alternate reality or anything, but it is an ideal reality.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, it doesn't strike me as fictional, I guess that's part of the thing of just, you know, on this side of the question, you believe it to the point where you can actually try to write it, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, so you have to see it, and in order to see it, it has to be at some level real, I think.
Yeah. You know? Well, you're a storyteller, and I
guess
think
so.
Do you think of yourself as a storyteller?
Yeah, I don't really have a clear view of that. I mean, I think there's narratives always going on, like, I guess in that level, but the narratives are not really like car chase scenes and stuff going on, right?
It's very vivid, detail-oriented lyricism, and the music, you're clearly drawn, and I want to get into where these influences maybe come from, but you're clearly drawn to strange sounds, or just like they're pop frameworks in a lot of ways, but you have an ear for odd, off-kilter sounds, I'd say, my observation. Mm-hmm. Is it getting too heavy for you all of a sudden?
No.
I'm just trying to break you down here for people.
But no.
Is that
no, that's I'd go with that. Sure.
You have a penchant for this.
Yeah, I've again, and that would go right back to Hendrix, you know.
Yeah.
The sound is multidimensional, and it's still musical. You know, that it's not commonly, you can't put your finger on it.
Yeah.
But it's still can illustrate something. I think that's fantastic. It's the same thing that we sort of pick up occasionally at the jazz festival here in town.
The Guelph Jazz Festival definitely is all about that, I think.
Yeah.
All about really pushing the boundaries of what you think is possible. With like the people that blow you away the most, and I think you're definitely among them, is someone who can take an instrument that you think you know and show you something you don't. And I think that's something that you seem drawn to, like pushing things a little.
Pushing, to be honest, pushing myself too, because I do get a little bit, there's a saying, if you can say what it is, don't do it. And I think I'm a little bit, driven by that idea, you know. Just a little bit, not fully. Like, yeah. I'm not committed to this, you know, completely be obtuse or something.
No, and I don't think that you're, yeah, there are people that try these things, and I think it's obvious that they're trying. But I think that there is an effort. The things that I think that your fans are drawn to is the kind of, I keep using the word organic, and it just makes me hungry. But this sort of natural, effortless exploration. You seem like an explorer in your work, if that makes sense.
I think that's true, and it's not like I'm not out to prove anything that with that.
Yeah.
I'm really just out, like, particularly in the studio. There's lots of things I do that just, to me, they just don't work. And other people hear them and they say, well, that's neat, you know. But I hear it and I say, but it has nothing to do with the song, you know, this sound.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very fussy that way.
Yeah.
And it's really, until it makes sense to me on a personal level somehow, I can't really get behind it, you know.
Yeah.
And so it makes it, such a slow process sometimes, but I got nothing really to lose.
I think it's a fine line between trying to do something that transcends the mundane yet also makes sense, you know? Like, it's one thing for something to be wild and strange and exhilarating, but I think what you're saying is that that same thing should have some practical purpose in what you're doing.
That's a good way of putting it, actually. I mean, it's clear.
It's a clear way of putting
it. Yeah.
I was thinking of Brantford, Ontario. I'm from Cambridge, Ontario, originally, which is, I don't know, half an hour away, something like that. And we used to go to... I was obsessed with Brantford. Because,
really?
Yeah, I was. Brantford, for those who don't know, and correct me if I'm wrong, you live there. Working class town.
Yeah.
For a long time. Industry left and it was really crippled, I think.
Completely.
But I knew it because Wayne Gretzky was from there and he was my favorite hockey player. So we would go on school trips perhaps most significantly, Alexander Graham Bell. What, did he live there or did he invent the telephone in Brantford?
I think he had a cottage there or something.
There's a house. You can go and see his house.
Yeah, yeah. Is that where you went?
We would go on school trips.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And as we were coming into Brantford on, I guess it's Highway 24, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get to way before you get to downtown, for the longest time there was a Woolco.
Yep.
And I think at one point it was a Woolworths. I think it was the same. That Woolco is where Wayne Gretzky's mom bought him she bought sprinklers to make the ice rink in the backyard.
Wow.
So I would be staring out the school bus window at a Woolco. We had Woolcos in Cambridge, but I was just obsessed with Woolco.
That's the Woolco.
I'm pretty sure that's the Woolco. And so we would go, we'd be on our way to downtown and I'd just be longingly, you know,
that's crazy.
Head craned back at this Woolco, and we would go in there sometimes on family trips and I'd just be like, this is the Woolco. This is ground zero for Gretzky.
Wow.
I could be wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure that in his autobiography, which I believe is called Gretzky, Wayne talks about that Woolco. So I think I was just like, holy cow. So anyway, I knew Brantford for Gretzky and the telephone. What was your experience like growing up there? Because I'm curious if that upbringing sort of informs what you're doing now and your kind of escapism. If we can call your work escapism in any way.
Okay.
You see where I'm going with this?
I see it, yeah. Yeah, we could debate the escapist thing a little bit. But
sure.
No, I see what you're saying. The town, like you said, was really industrial. It was completely a manufacturing town. There was a Mohawk College there, and a very small effect on the town as far as the majority of people and how they made their living.
Mohawk College was kind of like a vocational school?
Well,
or like a
you know, Hamilton's is extension of the Hamilton College. So yeah, you know, yeah.
You're going into, I mean, like any school, really. I feel like university in Canada, in university, you're kind of, it's more abstract. In some degrees, it's like, I'm doing English. And you're like, well, yeah. What are you going to do with that? But you go to Mohawk, you might be, you know, you take a trade.
Practical, yeah.
Yeah, like a
practical applying to.
Which these days I think might have been a more sensible option for myself. But yeah, anyway, yeah, so you went to, it wasn't a college town per se, but it had a college.
It had a little college, but didn't have much of an effect, as I guess. So yeah, I always had eventually it developed this sort of feeling that any place with a university was chances there would be real gigs for what I was doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For some reason, I never thought that out of the box, but it eventually became apparent that was the case. That's where the cafes and songwriter places were for some whatever reasons. But so Brantford had that feeling. Didn't have that feeling. It was very, very rare that music would happen outside of the high school. You know, high school bands would come in, but that would be, generally speaking.
Were they actually high school bands, or didn't like Rush play a bunch of high school? It was bands.
Yeah, yeah,
would come
yeah,
to your
yeah,
high school.
Those days, yeah. I guess you clarify, because that completely doesn't happen anymore, I guess.
No, but like, I think at a point, there was a point where like Alice Cooper would play your high school or something. Maybe that's too big. But
that'd be a bit much for our high school anyways.
But did you see anyone of significance?
I would have seen Rush. I would have seen Max Webster a number of times, probably.
Featuring Kim Mitchell?
Yeah, featuring Kim Mitchell. And in those days, they were doing pretty outside stuff for what we were used to. There were bands like Breathless, which I think had I believe you could maybe correct me, but I think Nash the Slash, it was one of his first bands, I think.
The recently deceased Nash the Slash.
Yeah.
He just passed away.
Yeah. So there was some stuff going on that way, but it was really like barely a glimpse compared to what you could find at the record store, you know. And eventually the town sort of closed up because all the factories one by one sort of all disappeared. And so that it just became grew darker and darker in my eyes anyways.
What was the main industry in Brantford? Was it automobile?
No, it was farm machinery.
Okay.
Massey Ferguson was the main one. White Farm was the other. But there was countless other industries, like Spalding had a factory there.
The ball people?
Yeah.
Like the people that make the basketballs?
Yeah, yeah. Harding Carpets. On and on, like literally... dozens of factories, and then any summer you needed a job, you'd just go out for the afternoon, throw in applications, you know,
at these places,
at any one of these places, and you know, you'd be probably working within a week or two, you know. It'd be it was easy pickings, and really you could see how it was a really easy lifestyle to sort of slip into.
This was the 70s.
Yeah, so 70, let's say, early 70s.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, early to mid 70s.
And did you finish, you went to high school?
Yeah.
And you finished?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Did you go to post-secondary?
Didn't do anything after
So after high school, were you doing these jobs?
I would do jobs in the summers, generally when I was in high school.
Yeah.
I was in high school, yeah.
Okay.
And when I finished school, I just basically, I was going to go to, Guelph was a possibility. I'd been accepted in a couple of arts programs, but I broke the news to my folks that I was going to actually kick the can with music for a year and see how that went. And it was difficult because everybody else in the family had gone on to school. So I've always sort of felt a little bit like it was a bit of a disappointment to the folks.
Yeah, it's a societal thing. I think no matter what, when you go into the arts and you live modestly, I think you can't help but feel
a little scared.
Let you've potentially, you're not necessarily doing a real thing. You know, we've been talking about reality and alternate reality and imagination, and I think in some ways we live in imagination forever or something when you do this sort of stuff. And that's healthy for us, but, you know,
not so good for
when your in-laws spend 3 weeks with you. You realize that maybe you feel like everything you've done is a mistake.
Oh, yeah. I don't know.
Were your parents probably? I've had a number of conversations with people about this sort of stuff. Yeah. So I assume when you tell your parents this, they are probably more concerned. I mean, was there any element of support?
Not much at first.
Yeah.
Not much at first. You know, they didn't. You know, they were the support, I guess. Yeah, I shouldn't say. Not much is the right answer. There was support, though, in that they let me live at the house still. It wasn't like they, you know, said, okay, go out into the real world, kid, and see what happens in 2 weeks, let alone 6 months or whatever.
Yeah.
So, to their credit, they did that. But I remember every night my father would come home, and he worked. He was very dedicated to supporting the family and the whole generational thing of being the breadwinner. And he would, you know, we didn't see him for a lot of those years because he would work from, he'd be up before us and home just in time for dinner and bed, basically, for him to get up and do it the next day. So anyways, when, you know, he would come home from work during that first year that I was sort of just trying to do stuff, and he would say pretty much every other night, so, you know, what did you do today? You know, that's all he needed to say, and was sort of always, it's like a brand in the
back. Isn't it amazing? It's such minimal, like, syntax.
Yeah.
How much meaning? Like, it's like when a parent says,
so loaded.
Yeah, a parent can say, like, the most, it sounds, if you read it on paper, most benign thing, but it's so loaded.
Yeah.
What did you do today?
Yes.
It's also the tone.
Yes. Where the sharp note is.
Yeah, exactly.
What did you do today?
So you've got this, and so this obviously stayed with you. And what were you doing in your days at that point? Were you writing songs?
I was writing, and I was trying to play better. I had this elaborate exercises set up for playing and sort of time. It was like kind of like physical exercise in a way, part of the day. And part of the day was just using the telephone to try to see what the lay of the land is, even, you know.
Cause it invented was by Alexander Graham Bell.
Yes, just
using a hometown invention. Yeah.
Yes.
What do you mean you were calling out to?
I'd call out to, you know, random clubs that I saw had songwriters playing in them, you know, and seeing what existed, and kind of anything, you know, anything at all.
Were you always, so initially were you like more of a folk artist, so to speak?
Yeah, that's,
were you ever in bands or anything?
I started in the garage band sort of thing through school and right up through the end of school, basically. Had a band, and we would play at grade school graduations around town and blood donor clinics and, you know, Knights of Columbus events.
Blood donor clinics.
Yeah.
Was that common?
We were...
For bands to play a blood donor clinic?
No. I think music would be. They'd entertain
the
these
people who are just like,
Yeah, lying in their beds.
They need donuts and cookies and music.
Yeah,
to get them back.
Covers. Yeah.
So, what was the band called?
It was called Max Rat. Max Rat.
Influenced by Max Webster?
No, it was before Max Webster.
Oh, okay.
Well before Max Rat started. When I was, you know, shortly after Stanley Plotchenik had introduced me to Jimi Hendrix.
So Max Rat, and you were playing Hendrix covers and other obsessions of the time.
Whatever the sort of heavy rock stuff,
right?
Black Sabbath eventually. And
was there a moment where you realized this was songwriting was a thing you could do?
No, I think it felt very bogus to me eventually. Like it felt like we were, you know, like the covers were very loose. They were very undisciplined, and
oh,
and the the singer, I could tell the guy that was singing in the band, I don't think he really knew any of the words, you know? I think there was a lot of mumbling going on in the front. And it's not like anyone that we were playing to would have known these songs anyways, you know, most of the people at the Blood Donors Clinic were well into their, you know, middle 20s or something.
Yeah.
So we could get away with a lot, or I felt like we were getting away with a lot, and that sort of bugged me eventually.
That bugged you enough to be like, I'm going to try something on my own?
That's kind of what happened. Yeah. I mean, I'd listened to a few people that I realized...
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And you know, sort of getting into the, you know, middle of the 70s, I worked in a record store and listened to, and the guy was obsessed with Leo Kottke. And
oh, yeah, yeah.
So I started to hear more solo people, and the amount of dimension to that, just that kind of playing. And so I started thinking, yeah, these, you know, you take, it seemed to be much more another step somehow. You know, and once you sort of get that into your head, it's hard to let go of it when you're that age.
Was the record store in Brantford in a mall?
Yes, the one that I worked in was A&A Records.
And did it become a Sunrise Records?
It did.
We used to go to Brantford when Ticketmaster tickets would go on sale, when we would skip school, because it was one of the nearest ticket outlets, and we were naive, and we just... I mean, now I know how to buy tickets. I wouldn't necessarily drive somewhere and think that was the best.
Quite that simple. I don't even
That's
think
true.
In the 80s.
That's
right?
True. You had to go to the outlet and line up and be there on time to see REM or whoever you wanted to go see. So you would, I just remember we would go to Brantford. We would totally, on our spare in high school, go get tickets for stuff. And that's probably the story.
The same store, probably.
Yeah.
I think that the owner had long gone since then.
Yeah, yeah.
But
So the folk music circuit you were in at the time. I mean, did you stick? You probably. I would think your music stuck out in the folk circles.
Well, it was, because I didn't really know obviously what I was doing, you know. But I, and the influences were, you know, the things that I'd. Was amalgamating or putting in the stew were kind of fuzzy at best, right?
Yeah,
it was very
yeah.
fuzzy sources I was drawing from. And I mean, I guess that's part of the problem was that I kind of loved everything, you know, when I first heard it. And
would try to incorporate into what you were doing?
Yeah, try to put it, that's right, put a fuzz pedal on this too. Yeah, but in the... folk clubs, it was hard going too, you know. I mean, I was really too young, and there was a bit of a scene that was pretty established. There was a guys a generation ahead of me that were maybe a bit more than a generation ahead of me, you know.
But so you would go to Toronto and that
Toronto,
circuit?
Toronto, the college towns, you know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There was a place in London called Change of Pace. Hmm. There was a place in Kingston, called Bitter Grounds, I think it was called.
Bitter Grounds?
Bitter Grounds, yeah.
It's kind of coffee thing?
Yeah. Coffee houses, you know.
Coffee houses.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was like that refuge for songwriters. It was fantastic. It was like a very attentive crowd, so everything was, you know, everything you did was sort of heard, and it was... nerve-wracking, but anyways, that didn't come easily at all. Getting into those places, it was pretty established who was playing in them. They were very nice people, very kind, and they were hippies, you know.
Yeah.
And but at the same time, you know, you're just a kid, so I'd sort of was really at the point, I think. I don't know if it's true entirely, but I think I was at the point where I was giving up when I said, I'd do this one gig. Like the one gig I got where it was sort of the end of the line. It was this.
You didn't feel like you were.
I didn't feel like I'd done any. It had been a year and nothing was really. There was no circuit to play. There was no agencies. There was no management things.
Yeah.
It was a wilderness, and I was, you know, 18 or 19 years old, and nothing was going on, and I was had parents. What did you do today, son?
Yeah, right.
You know, and I went to this one club that said, "Yeah, I'd come down in Hamilton, a place called the Night Two Coffee House," and said, "Come down. You know, we have a pay or play night. You just, you know, if you play, you don't pay, and that's the deal." Oh, this is progress, you know. So I drove down. I was very cynical, and I went with a friend, and everything sort of changed after that. That was like this little club, and I looked in, and it was like maybe 30 people. It really was a tiny, tiny room, and the guy that ran it called me the next day and invited me back to do an opening spot. It was like, you know, a little, and then everything sort of just grew in quite, you know, slow but and small, but at least it felt like there was something going on, you know, like.
Well, I think when you get that, when someone, and you know, outside of your circle of friends or someone pays attention to you and encourages you, that's a huge boost, right?
Yeah.
Particularly after struggling for so long. I mean, what was the trajectory from that moment and those opportunities to starting to work with the labels that you would end up working with?
Well, I made a couple of records. I can't get the timeline completely straight. I did these opening sets for a while, played the coffee house, got in one coffee house. You do one place, the other people would.
Yeah,
it was a small community. Yeah. And it was all telephones, and mm-hmm. you know, it was a couple of folk festivals that, you know, took a chance, and I grew a beard so I'd look a little bit older.
How old were you?
Well, you know, I was 19 or 20,
yeah, okay.
You know,
yeah.
I guess. And so there was a studio in Hamilton that was always heard about among the songwriters that were making records. There weren't a lot of us, weren't a lot of people making records because it was such a process in those days, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they told me about the place in Hamilton that was friendly to songwriters and had a couple of good people working there. And so I went down and did a couple of demo sessions and figured, oh, you know, I could probably make a record. And the guy at one of the clubs was starting to take me on as kind of a manager. He was trying to manage me a little bit and organized a way for me to generate enough income that I could pay for a record. And so then I worked towards that, finished that record. Traveled around, sold it out of the boxes at the end of the sets, you know.
What was the record?
It was called Desperate Cosmetics. It was just a sort of a collection of whatever I had managed to get through the strainer at the time.
And were you, you know, we haven't even touched upon this, but you are a renowned producer now. You work with lots of people. Circle of friends and
yeah.
And clients and things like that. And were you home recording at that point?
No.
You were going into studios?
Not really. No, pretty much going in cold.
To studios?
To studio. Yeah, go in with, you know, I could see players on, you know, I'd be at festivals, for instance. I'd say, oh, these guys. And they're, you know, and I figured out, oh, these guys can actually play really quickly. They can pick up on stuff and they can write charts and they mm-hmm. can sort of accompany you without too much trouble. And, you know, a lot of the, like, percussionist drummers and bass players. So I could get a, you know, at the festivals, the very few that I'd played, I approached a couple of guys, and they were completely open to playing with anyone because it's work, you know. And so, yeah, I went in with a group of players, got the records done, the first record done, and sold it out and figured out, well, I could just put this towards the next record because I had a lot of new ideas that I thought I'd really like to try now that I know how the studio kind of works, you know. And so that record, the following record, which is called Serious Interference, was another completely independent thing. But a couple of radio stations had gotten it. I think must have been people at gigs or something that were DJs, you know,
yeah.
that were just passionate about music. It started playing it on a couple of stations in Toronto, and that sort of got the antenna up of other labels because it was, you know, Canadian gold.
You know? And so you started to get attention. And what was the first label was it
Duke Street Records?
Duke Street Records. Mm. What was that? I don't even know what that is.
What you know? So like a. They were sort of a going concern in the 80s. Their main thing that they developed a name around was Jane Siberry's Records.
Oh, of course. Okay, yeah. So it sounded familiar, but I'm like, what is that? I there's so many little record labels. But,
yeah. Yeah. No. Okay. And it's hard for any, like, you know, I'm sure mm-hmm. with the landscape has changed so much. You forget how much rarer it was then for there to be a little label. There were only a couple of them around.
And rare for people to make records in their homes and things like that too, I imagine.
It completely.
There was this separation. You know, one of the great advances of independent culture, I think, was this sense of, like, anyone can do this. For better or for worse, anyone can do this. But I think probably when you were coming up, there was this mysticism to being on a label. Like, the industry was set up to make it seem like it was done by people who knew what they were doing.
Yeah, it's behind the curtain.
Yeah. So you don't want to get involved in the recording. You don't want to get involved in putting out your own records. It's too much. You need us to do it.
Yeah.
And eventually, obviously, that has shifted.
Well, I was sort of convinced of that myself, to be honest. Yeah. Like, I was convinced that this is too much work to do. Like, I was, you know, in order to sell records, I would have to go to warehouses, and, you know, like, there was Sam's in Toronto, mm-hmm. Robinson's was their distributor. So I'd go to those places, and, you know, anytime they called, I'd have to deliver a couple more boxes of records. So I'd have to get in my van and drive to Toronto, deliver a couple boxes. And, you know, I'd had a thing where record stores would call for records directly, you know, small independent stores, and you'd have to drive and consign records at those places, go back and check them the next month and make sure they had records. So it was like, I really did honestly feel like I this is not what I really want to do, you know, like that whole part of it started taking up a lot of time.
Yeah.
So the label seemed like a godsend when they started to poke the stick and through the fence. It felt like, yeah, this is a real logical way to try to get back to just playing music.
Yeah, I'm actually making the thing. And you ended up working with IRS, which was a subsidiary of a major label, or they put out REM records.
Yeah, that's REM was their main thing at the time, I think. Miles Copeland was the guy.
Stuart Copeland's brother.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you interact much with Miles?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And mostly I dealt with a guy there, Jay Boberg, who was a really good guy. And he went on to Universal in Los Angeles, and when he went there, he called me. This was years later, and did the last record.
On MCA.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So what did you do with IRS? What record did you make?
I made a record called Violet and Black.
And was the experience a good one?
I wouldn't describe it as the best experience because I liked I do feel okay about the final recording. I know I felt really strongly about it at the time, but it was a pretty bleak to my. I really got to the point where I was thinking, okay, now I'll just try to write in a more of a documentary kind of style, even if it was sort of like you're saying, fantastic or something. I was trying to, fantastic in the sense of like, you know, otherworldly.
Yeah.
I was really trying to write about, Violet and Black was really trying to write about the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, Brantford was in pretty rough shape.
Right.
And my neighborhood was in rough shape. And I was losing a lot of, you know, it was all the casualties that go along with that sort of culture when it starts to get ugly. So I tried to write more about that without being too hopeless about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a dark record, and I think in a lot of ways it built its own karmic thing because of that. The songs were like that. The recording was done in, a lot of it was done in Los Angeles, and John had been just born.
Oh, okay.
And I was away for months on end making this record with Arthur Barrow in Los Angeles, and it was very unreal and sort of a disturbing period of time. So I don't have the best feelings about that record, to be honest.
Were these the sessions that included Adrian Ballou of King Crimson?
No, those was another. There was a record after. There was a record between Serious Interference and called Gravity is Mutual.
Right, of course.
That was done for, that was a Duke Street record. And that was done with Roma Baron. That was a fun record to make because it was the band that I had at the time. We'd been playing, you know, when the stuff started working out with, when I first... whoever those DJs were in Toronto that were spinning the record, whenever they started doing that, I started getting these nicer offers in Toronto to play. I could actually get a real band together and start playing kind of like what the records actually were.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was exciting. So that band actually coalesced eventually, and in time that Duke Street for that signing and that first record. So that was a nice record to make.
Well, how do you come to work with Adrian Ballou?
Roma Baron was the producer. She was someone I around the time I'd heard Laurie Anderson for the first time.
Mm.
She, I thought, was really fantastic. It was like late night radio at my little apartment in Brantford in the hovel, and it was like you know, another one of those kind of Stanley Plotchenik moments.
Yeah, key moments. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And she knew Adrian?
Well, so I immediately went out and checked out what Laurie Anderson was about. Again, no internet or anything, so it's a little bit of a process. You know, you have to order the record and then wait and then listen and then read the liner notes and then inquire. And I inquired after her producer, who is Roma Baron, who is an expat Canadian living in New York, and hooked up with her. For the record, she was great, and she was, because of Laurie Anderson, was acquainted with a whole circle of musicians that some of them came into the project for a few tracks.
Okay, okay. So it wasn't like Adrian was necessarily a big fan or anything?
No. It was, you know, Roma calling a favor, paying him the big bucks.
Was it cool for you?
Oh yeah, it was fantastic. Yeah. Are you kidding? It was really great. It was just a great, a lot of really good stuff around that record as far as just the way and the lights that came on during the process of making it. One of them was for sure working with Adrian Ballou, where the whole chaos thing was.
Yeah.
His management of chaos was fantastic, and it was, you know, especially we'd done all the bed tracks, so everybody's kind of precious, you know, about how to do things, and he would come and he just start slapping his pedals on the floor, you know, and his had a, you know, crazy stuff coming out of the speakers, and he didn't know what half of it was, you know. I mean, the first sound, it was like 10 o'clock in the morning for the session. It took like a couple of hours for him to get the rig happening because it was sort of hilarious. But yeah, so it took a couple hours to get the rig going. But when he did, the first thing he hit was this strange combination of, it's like a, sounded kind of like a dentist drill. and he just sort of slapped it on top of these tracks, you know, and I was just sort of like, I don't know. Like, I don't know. And Roma's sort of smiling and looking at me saying, this is great, this is great. I'm sort of like, I don't know, Roma. And Adrian sort of up on his chair, he was up on his chair looking, then coming up to Roma with the end of his guitar saying, good morning. He's
putting like the, a rifle?
Yeah, kind of like a rifle. In the, well, more like a, I thought like a dentist drill. Like,
okay.
Good morning.
You say dentist drill, I say rifle. I mean, that's various levels of safety there. Yeah. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so, but it was a thing of working with people that were would manage chaos.
Yeah.
In those situations.
Like, I can see you being attracted to that.
Totally.
Being kind of into the chaos and yet that again that management of the chaos. I can see you being like, it's cool to harness the unknown.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's, so the, he had a high batting average.
Yeah,
you know the stuff of what he could do.
Yeah,
and I mean, it's not that, you know. I mean, other people I'd work with were into those sorts of things, like with, you know, making devices to exaggerate tones and things, and it wasn't completely foreign or something, but it was great to see it just happening with a guitar.
Yeah.
And a guy with a big smile on his face because he's just
enjoying it, yeah.
Shock value of what he's doing, you know.
It's been 12 years, I think, since...
Is it? Yeah.
The Detour Home came out, which is your last record. And
I'm not sure if it's a capital L or a little L for last.
But, yeah. Oh, really?
Well, I often wonder, you know, whether... Whenever I finished something, I always thought... I don't know.
You've been obviously busy working with other people, but mm-hmm. what stage are you at in terms of making your own music?
I did finish another last record. I did finish a record, and I've sort of, yeah. So that's, I don't know how to elaborate on it too much.
When did you finish it?
On Friday.
Sorry, this past Friday?
Yeah.
It's a couple days ago.
Yeah.
You finished your last record, your most recent record.
I think so, yeah.
And how long have you been working on it?
Since probably Tuesday or so.
You started it on Tuesday and you finished it on Friday?
Yeah, I think so.
Is it a pretty sparse affair?
No, I should be honest about it. I cannot tell a lie. I started it maybe a year ago. It started in between projects, mm-hmm. just doing this thing. The whole ukulele, I went back to ukulele and started kicking around these real simple little ideas and thinking, oh, there's a real simple little project to do. And of course, you know, it's never as simple as it looks at the outset.
Right. But,
so that's still in there, I think, is the nugget of this sort of attempt to be really simplify and to have, be more essential in everything, and I really don't. I'm still not sure why, what I'm going to do with it. I know why I did it, but I don't really know what I'm going to do about it.
Now, when you say you don't know what you're going to do about it, does that have to do with you're not sure what the demand might be for it?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, and you know, I mean, it's the I've always really enjoyed the making of stuff, and I think most artists I know are like this. You mm-hmm. know, we love making stuff, but the work behind justifying it by selling it, like, you know, distribution.
Yes. All the stuff we covered earlier. Yeah.
So
the business side is not fun.
No, they've never been great bedfellows. And
yeah, I hear you.
In my life, anyways, and I see it in all my friends. You know, the amazing artists to me are. It's amazing to me when I see artists that can do everything. Cover the whole thing. It just makes me more appreciative of what, you know, holy crow, you know, say what you want about, you know, the commerciality of this person. But yeah. It's amazing to me that they do all these things and they dance and they sing.
They're doing it all. They're covering all the bases. Okay. So that notwithstanding, what can you tell me anything about your headspace around these songs? If you see things coming through in them now that you've reflected. Did you literally finish it on Friday?
Yeah, I did actually just finish. I did the last mix on Friday.
And was it okay? I don't know how much I want to get into because I don't want to spoil surprises for anyone who's going to eventually hear it. But I'm curious about at this point what you maybe can you give us a sense of maybe what's going on the record in terms of maybe lyrically, tonally.
I guess it's, to start with, it's simple, right? I wanted it to be simple and essential feeling, and a few years back, we found when we were sorting out my mother-in-law's estate, her house, after she passed away, we found a ukulele under her bed that didn't make any sense to us at all because she just wasn't a ukulele player by our vision of her. And what the heck, I'll take it home. And I, shortly after that, we went to an island and I took it with me, and just because I could get it on carry-on luggage. And the I was sort of amazed at how simple and complete things were whenever I picked it up. You know, I felt like I could play for a couple of minutes, but it felt like it was something complete just happened. And you know, it was a very unusual feeling.
Had you played much ukulele before? The ukulele chords and things are a bit different than maybe what you're...
A little bit different, you know, and the shapes are kind of the same as guitar.
Yeah.
So you could get away with, you know, and that's part of it too, you're playing by ear, so it's a lot of it is the intuition of a new instrument, which is always sort of an exciting thing.
Yeah. Oh, so you hadn't, before this, you hadn't much played ukulele?
I played the uke when I was shortly after the pie plate.
Oh, right.
So, you know, it but nothing to, you know, barely worth mentioning at that point. Anyways, so that was really the start of the idea of the record, which is going back a few years
now.
And I thought, oh, it'd be neat to just write a bunch of songs with this very simple little instrument. But it didn't turn out to be quite that simple, you know.
Right.
The record feels more like a trio or a quartet, but what those other instruments are is kind of interpretive. you know, you don't know what that third instrument is sometimes, but it is like a, kind of, to my ear, it's like a three-piece or a four-piece at its biggest, and one person at its smallest. You know.
Okay.
Does that help?
It does, and so did the experience of discovering the ukulele, and you know, that's a heavy thing to discover that someone you knew for a long time and quite well had this thing hidden under her bed that is out of character, or at least of your perception of her. Does that inspire anything going on the record, or is that too specific?
No, that wouldn't be too specific. I think it's a difficult one to talk about. I know very specifically what the record is about.
But you do.
Part of the thing is, I wanted to sort of couch the ideas. You know what I mean? I wanted I wanted them to be sort of not zeros and ones as far as description goes, you know? I wanted it to be a like, I guess, like you're saying, is there's this when you're describing other things, maybe it's the same pattern of there's a narrative, but it's, I've always thought of it as like a flip book narrative, you know, it's sort of like these images that you line up and you flip and then, oh, there's a story. It's
there's
like
a through line there, but you're, I see. I think I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, sorry. It's I know it sounds very abstract. I'm sort of, I sound like I'm kind of avoiding it, and I kind of am, because
I had the experience recently of talking to someone about their forthcoming album, and we went through this exercise of them going through the meaning of each and every song before anyone's heard it.
Right.
And on one level, I was really excited that he agreed to do this because it's a highly anticipated record. But in retrospect, I'm like, did we just ruin the record for everyone?
Right.
Who is going to come at it fresh? And I actually appreciate the fact that you just finished a record a few days ago and you want to let it sit with people rather than over-explain it.
Mm.
I assume if and when you end up doing some press or something about it, it might come out, people might ask you the right questions. I'm talking about a thing I have not heard a note of.
Yeah, right.
So maybe, yeah, I totally see where you're coming from, and I can't wait to hear it and make my own calls and then bother you on the phone and be like, hey, this is what I think is going on, and you could be like, no, you're wrong.
Yeah, I'd be probably a little bit more comfortable with that one. Yeah,
yeah.
That stage.
Okay.
Game, yeah. Well, it's, you know, when and if, yeah.
On behalf of Scott Merritt fans everywhere, I can say, you know, we've obviously, it's exciting news.
Well,
I hope you figure out what to do with it.
Both get a copy of it. Hope you can both.
That's how I feel about this show sometimes. Oh, people are like, oh, it's great. I'm like, oh, so you're the one. You're the one listening to the show. I can't tell you how excited that is. And so you're playing the show in Guelph.
Yes.
On the, that I helped put together on the 11th of September at the E-Bar, and you're playing in a duo?
Yeah. Jeff Bird and I.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And is Jeff on the record?
Jeff's on the record.
Okay.
Yeah, upright bass.
So will you be playing some of these new songs?
Yeah, you know, chances are all, if not, you know.
Wow.
Probably all the songs will be represented. I mean, I won't be playing the whole record, but I'll be playing all the songs that will be in the set will be from the record, I'm guessing, just because I'm generally that way.
That's great.
No, I don't have much. I like to be doing stuff that I'm doing as opposed to stuff I've done as much as possible.
That's really exciting. I can't wait to, this is makes it even more amazing, because it's a rare, I think there's a perception anyway that it's a rare thing to see you play live. You're pretty, you know, it's not something you do that often.
No.
Which is good. You know, I think that's good. I feel like you're following a path and it is what it is.
Yeah, that's, I don't feel like I have much choice in it. There's a lot of ways. I just sort of have to let it do, let it become what it wants to become or not, you know, and that's the way it's, just has to be that way at this point of the game.
Well, that's great. I can't wait. That makes it even more exciting. No, not to disparage any of your older material. I'd like to, love to hear it, obviously, but the fact that we're getting, you know, this nice premiere of a whole batch of new stuff, that's great. I'm happy for you.
Oh, well, thanks, Vish.
Now, I hate to put you on the spot. Normally, at this point, I would ask the artist or guest on my show if they have music or something, if we can play something. And, you know, we could go back to some of your old stuff, but is there something new we can play for folks?
Yeah, as to, I'd be game for that.
No, that's very kind of you. Does your album have a name?
No, it doesn't at this point.
Okay. Do the songs have names?
I think most of them have names.
Okay.
Well, I'm not sure what song I can give you still that would maybe be most of use to you, but maybe this song that called Ever Will, which is about this idea of a parade that has no beginning and no end. That one, maybe.
A parade that has no beginning, or that's amazing. I like that idea. Wait a minute. I also don't... There's a possibility that that is nothing. A parade that has no beginning or no... Wait, is that life? Never mind. I'm not going to interpret the... Because that sounds a lot like life to me. But I'm not going to have some kind of critical assessment of the thing you just said. I'm just going to, like everyone, very excitedly enjoy Everwill. And we'll give it a shot.
Thanks, Vish.
Is that cool?
That's good, yeah. We'll go with that.
Scott, it was really, you know, I've known you a long time, and I learned more about you in the last hour. We talk a lot, I think.
Yeah.
We try to. But that's very revealing. I appreciate the chat, and I wish you the obviously good luck with everything. And
yeah, thanks.
Really excited to see you making...
Appreciate your interest.
Okay.
Brass bands marching, floating on trumpets and Labor Day. They're all lit up as it ever would. The red convertible queen waves over the parted sea. They're all lit up, all lit up again.
Thanks again for checking out Creative Control with Vish Khanna. You can email me about the show at creativecontrol933@gmail.com. That's creative with a K,
control with a K, 933@gmail.com. You can also follow our Twitter at Vish Creative, VishKreative. And you can also like our Facebook page. A version of this show airs on CFRU in Guelph every Wednesday at noon Eastern. And you can listen to that online at CFRU.ca, or if you're in the KW region, at 93.3 FM in Guelph. You can also sign up for the weekly mailing list for the podcast and the show at vishkana.com, and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. I believe that is everything I wanted to tell you. Thank you once again.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.